and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the twice weekly podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thank you so much for tuning in, wherever you are, in the UK and indeed the rest of the world. And this is the time of week where we have a conversation together with somebody. And this week we're going to look at trains, one of the themes of our times together at the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative, because the state of the railways has so many layers to it as a theme to make sense of. The lack of control, the poor delivery, the lack of accountability, the kind of fractured levels of ownership. And yet it should be such a joy, railways. And we've explored many of the kind of themes in our time together over the months and indeed years we've been examining the state of this bloody country. Anyway, I thought it would be great to speak to someone who is an absolute expert on railways in the UK now, the past, so we have a bit of context to make sense of it all, to look at the wider implications. What does it tell us about ownership, public ownership, private ownership, as well as just why the heck we can't get our act together on this front? And of course, it's been another week of strikes, but on so-called normal days, which are pretty abnormal. You've got no idea whether you're going to get a train. Why is it worse in the north of England? Yeah, so many themes, which, as I say, relate to much bigger questions about the condition of Britain in 2023. So who better to reflect on these themes than Christian Wolmer, who, as I say, has been writing about railways and all kinds of different guises and outlets for many years. And his most recent outlet is he's got a podcast called Calling All Stations, where Christian explores all aspects of transport. And yeah, he's got a blog and everything. So sit back or go running, or if you're listening on a train, you're lucky to be on a train. Here is our conversation where we attempt to make sense of the railways and what it tells us about Britain. Christian Wolmer, thanks so much for coming in. We're obsessed on this podcast about trains and what they represent on many different levels. I want to go quite big in terms of context and so on, but could I begin with a small but perhaps symbolic issue? Is it really the case that when we roll up to a train station, whether it's the north of England, London or whatever, and you see train cancelled, it's partly to do with the fact that there isn't a rota for 7 day working on the trains? Because I heard Mick Lynch challenge that. So is it the case that some train companies really aren't set up for a 7 day rota?
That's absolutely right. Some of the companies, post and even pre-privatisation, so back in the 90s, some areas of British Rail and some of the train companies that were set up in the mid-90s did sort this out. And so they did deals locally with their drivers for a seven-day rota. And that, of course, meant a pay increase for the drivers, but it meant that they no longer got extra for doing Sunday working in particular, for which they used to get one and a half, twice the normal wage. But so the rail companies, the clever ones, did buy this out. But the other ones just let this fester for the whole period of a quarter of a century of privatization. They haven't sorted it out. And so therefore, that gives the drivers the possibility of a kind of tacit industrial action, which, of course, the unions deny this. But there's no doubt that if all the drivers suddenly say, oh, we're not going to work on a Saturday or even Sunday, and we're going to spend more time with our family and we don't really need the money, and they all do it together, they cause total chaos for the rail company. And one could say that it's a form of industrial action, even though...
But in some cases, it's not just that, is it? They might choose, oh, we don't want to work this weekend. We won't opt for that sort of, in inverted commas, overtime. And they run out of drivers.
Absolutely. I mean, the drivers are well paid, right? They make no bones about this. They say that they're well paid because that's the rate for the job, because they've, over the years, negotiated a lot of productivity improvements, which is true. But nevertheless, they're on salaries of anything ranging from 50 to 70,000 a year, which is, you know, a good wage. So they do have the scope just to say, well, you know, I'm going to just spend Sundays with my kids. And, you know, if their partners work as well, you know, these are families that are on a six-figure sum for the year. And so they can afford to do that.
Yeah. So we're in this crazy situation where I think you and I have talked about this. The BBC, which I was on staff at the BBC for a long time, is not one of life's most efficient organisations, actually. But you would never have a situation where, say, at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, you have the Radio 4 announcer say, we have no newsreader. I'm sorry we can't bring you the report. We have run out of political correspondence. You staff a seven-day operation as an absolute basic premise. And isn't this a symbol of the chaos of the structure of British railways, that even that isn't done?
So the problem with Britain's railways is that we've got a kind of legacy structure from the days of British Rail. And what the railways did when they were privatised is they fragmented into lots of different companies, train operators, Network Rail, or Rail Track as it then was, the rolling stock companies, engineering companies, and so on. And that fragmentation also results in a fragmentation of industrial relations. So it is no longer possible for one overriding organization to negotiate change with the workforce. So what has happened is that it's ossified in the last 25 years, because you can't have kind of, you know, one bit of the organization kind of setting a set of rules and another bit of the organization not setting those rules. And so, in a way, this great privatization, which was supposed to be, you know, a search for efficiency and kind of, you know, better basis for the railway and so on, has actually broken up traditional industrial relations structures and ossified them where they were 25 years ago.
And another consequence of this, is it not, is that more widely, I kind of focused in on one issue, but there are, of course, so many issues. It's a very complex task running railways, is that with this current structure, no one's in charge, is it? Everyone's in charge and no one's in charge. It's very hard to see who is accountable and responsible at any given moment. There are fascinating moments, aren't there, where there's some crisis and a lot by instinct turn to the transport secretary. Transport secretary, nothing to do with me. I'm not running this thing. And then you turn to Network, oh, no, it's train company. Isn't this the fundamental problem?
Yes, no, absolutely. And what's more, there's a lot of games going on as well. So, you know, in an ideal world, actually, the transport secretary would make many of these decisions, because the Network Rail is owned by the government. The train operating companies are effectively controlled by the government now that they no longer... What happened was that they used to take the fares and keep the fares. They no longer do that because that proved impossible under COVID. So essentially, they are just management contractors with a very limited task. So really, the transport secretary is at the heart of this. But you don't want that. You don't want a politician to be making day-to-day decisions over the railways. What you want is another organisation to be there. Call it British Rail, for example. And so they were supposed to, under the current review, which was launched in 2018, would you believe, Steve? So it's taken 5 years. Under the current review, they finally announced last year there would be something called Great British Railways, which would effectively have this strategic oversight to be the quotes unquote guiding mind. But this has now been paralysed because politics is paralysed with the three prime ministers of the year and four transport secretaries and God knows what else. So, only three transport secretaries. We're ossified into a structure that is unworkable with nobody in charge, with people kind of playing games. So, for example, there was a deal on offer to the unions kind of quite recently. And then at the last minute, the government, and we don't quite know who that is, but it might have gone either to Jeremy Hunt or to Richie Sunak, said, oh, no, we have to impose some conditions. So we have to say, oh, we want to work towards driver-only operation throughout the network. Now, this is both technically impossible and from industrial relations impossible and from a revenue collection impossible. It's a completely daft idea. But somehow this idea came from somewhere. I don't even think the transport secretary made that decision. I think it was made above. And so it paralysed the negotiations. Anybody who has any knowledge of what the industrial relations in the railways are would know that you cannot put such an idea to the brothers and sisters and meet with any type of positive response. They just know that. But maybe these people up there in number 10, number 11, whatever, don't know that.
Yeah. Now, let's have a look at this Great British Railways proposition, which you say, you know, was proposed some time ago. It should, no sign whatever of it happening in the current chaos. If it were to take shape, would that answer the question, who's in charge of the railways? And we all, without hesitation, say this new institution. Or is it in that, what's the phrase, guiding light?
Guiding mind.
A guiding mind. Very revealing phrase, isn't it? Because it doesn't imply much leverage, much direct power. You're offering advice as a guiding mind or whatever. But would it be? Would that be the answer? Board is in charge, full stop.
Well, there's two versions of this. And there's a big debate within Whitehall and Westminster about this. So the original idea, which was put forward, remember, by Boris Johnson, remember him, and his transport advisor, Andrew Gilligan. And they were very much of a mind that you needed essentially a strong centre to run the railways. And certainly Andrew Gilligan, who was the driving force behind this review, even though it's called the William Schatz Review, he wrote most of it. You can see it's very well written, so it's written by a journalist. You can see that. So Andrew Gilligan kind of was very much of the idea that you needed to have control over all aspects of the railway, and they needed to be run by essentially a state organisation. So it was kind of a recreation of the old British Rail. But now we've been through two different prime ministers. We've got a sort of different kind of person in number 10 and a different transport secretary. And they've looked at this and they've listened to a lot of backbench Tory MPs who are very worried about this. They don't want a recreation of British Rail. They feel that, you know, there must be the incentive for the private sector to flourish within the structure. They want the strong private sector involvement. They think, mistakenly, but they think that, you know, there's amounts of money that the private sector wants to pour into the industry and so on. So they're looking at this Great British Railways and saying, no, we want an organisation that's still very much open to private sector involvement, that has a light touch and enables kind of, you know, a thousand flowers to bloom. And so that is stuck in Whitehall at the moment.
I mean, they are such contrasting visions, aren't they? And if it's the second one, it won't move us much further in trying to get an answer to the question, who's in charge?
Absolutely.
Because the thousand flowers will all think they have responsibility as they bloom, in inverted commas. We're in chaos again, if that's the vision.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, ironically, of course, that's what happened in the first place. Why do we have a review? Yeah. Because in May 2018, there was a real problem that what happened was that the train operators had got themselves contracts to run a certain amount of trains that actually Network Rail could not cope with, that Network Rail being the infrastructure operator. Nobody had actually consulted with Network Rail and say, well, we want X number of trains between, say, London and Manchester, and they couldn't actually have enough train paths. There's a limit of how many trains you can get on it. So that's what started the whole review process, the fact that there was this dissonance between what the train operators wanted and what Network Rail was capable of delivering. So they thought, we must have this guiding mind. But if you then open it up again to the private sector and say, well, you know, let your fowls and flowers kind of put in their bids and put out ideas to run extra trains and so on, we'll be back to the same chaos. So it's turned full circle. And Steve, there is total paralysis on it now. This is a one of the reasons why we're getting such a poor train service, because nobody quite knows what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I hope to be interviewing Andy Burnham on the podcast very soon. It is worse, much worse in the north of England, it seems. Why is it so much worse in the north of England, given that the structure is the same everywhere?
Well, they're just hit bad luck, really. They've got two franchises up there which are performing particularly badly. So the main intercity franchise, London to Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, and so on, Avanti, is in a complete state of chaos. They don't have this rest day working, so they have not incorporated that into their system. So they're reliant on the drivers volunteering to work.
Crazy.
It was a crazy system. But they inherited that and they haven't dealt with it. But then they've lost the staff. I've talked to drivers in Avanti and they just seem to have, the management just seems to have kind of, lost their way in terms of staff management relations. And that's, the railways have always been dependent on the goodwill of the workers prepared to run that extra mile to, if there's a delay for 2 hours, they don't knock off their shift. They just kind of continue running the train, all that sort of thing. So it's always reliant on goodwill, and that's collapsed. And then they've got this other franchise up there, TransPennine Express, which has also suffered from the lack of a rest day working agreement. Also seems to be particularly poorly managed. And it really ought to be able to cope, given that it doesn't run that many trains, but it's got a great shortage of drivers. Now, one of the reasons the shortage of drivers is COVID. We have to kind of accept that there is some historic problems here. COVID meant that you couldn't have two people in the cab, right? And not having two people in the cab meant that you couldn't have a trainee along with the experienced driver, because they might catch COVID. That was the kind of fear. And so therefore, much driver training, particularly the latter stages of the driver training, where really the trainee is just sitting next to an experienced driver, couldn't happen. So there is an overall shortage in the industry. But let me say, there's one completely daft aspect of this, is that, again, in the negotiations between government and the unions, the government come up with this idea saying to the drivers, well, there's going to be no redundancies until 2025. And the drivers have told me this, ASLEF, I had a conversation with them, say, well, actually, there's a great shortage of drivers. There should be no chance of any redundancies happening anyway. Why are you saying this? And all that is doing is encouraging some of our members to think, oh, there might be some redundancy terms on offer soon. So we're going to hope to take advantage of that. And so it's a kind of complete failure on the part of government to understand how the industry runs. And the North has just been particularly unlucky that the couple of main franchises up there have performed particularly badly. But there's other issues around the country, around England, it must be said, because Wales and Scotland have largely settled their differences with the trade union.
At the heart of this, isn't there, is partly a sort of, it's why railways are so interesting on many levels. There is a sort of ideological issue, isn't there, around ownership. Interestingly, Labour are very timid on the issue of ownership, aren't they? Blair and Brown basically bought the idea that the privatisations were fairly successful and had to be managed. Now, with Keir Starmer, it's quite interesting. He has reneged on all the other ownership propositions from the Corbyn era. But with railways, they are sort of, what are they saying?
Equivocating would be the word.
Equivocating. So there's no clarity there either, you're saying. Well, they're going to take them over, aren't they, when contracts run out, the train companies?
Steve, essentially, the railways are controlled by government at the moment, right?
Yeah.
What is the private sector got left? Because the operations were franchises, but they're no longer franchises. They're now management contracts. The big difference is that in the old days, there was an incentive for the private companies to get as many people using the railways as possible because they would keep the fares. So an extra tenner for them on the fares was an extra tenner for the company, and they'd go on their profits. Since COVID, that proved impossible, of course, because COVID reduced rail usage to 5 or 10% of normal. And so therefore, all the train operators would have gone bust. So they were essentially taken back and then given short-term management contract deals. So they're already essentially in the public sector. The Network Rail, which used to be Railtrack, that was a private company. And then in the early 2000s, essentially that proved unworkable as an arrangement for various things because of accidents, because of failure to actually deliver the refurbishment of the West Coast Main Line at any kind of reasonable price. It essentially went bust, was taken in by the government, and is now Network Rail, which is a government company. So much of the railways is in control. The key point, I think, is whether the Starmer government, which hopefully will happen in the next 18 months, 2 years, will have the guts to say, actually, we don't need to contract out all these services to the private sector. We could run them directly. And what's more, we could merge them all with Network Rail and create a new proper British Rail, which then would be at arm's length from government. We would no longer have the Department for Transport running things, which is a disaster, but we would have this kind of strong, independent organisation in much the same way as British Rail, about which I've written a book called BR, A New History.
Yeah, I want to ask you that next, actually, because again, on this podcast, one of our favourite themes is context. And you, as you said, have written this book about British Rail. And one of the interesting things is partly about how we view the past. It's become, you know, an image of soggy sandwiches on rubbish lines and strikes and so on. But you actually, in looking back, end up kind of, not uncritically, but it's a fascinating book because you put the downsides, but you end up saying, look, it really wasn't as bad as everyone thinks it was. And there's a strong case for British Rail.
Yes, I mean, British Rail had a 50-year history existence and struggled for much of it and went through various phases. So in the 1950s, there was a big investment program called the Modernisation Program, which was, you know, in today's money, about 15, 20 billion. So it was serious, serious money. But much of it was misspent. They didn't quite know what they wanted. There was always this nirvana, this search for the holy grail of a railway that would pay for itself, right? Which is a nonsense concept. Yeah, you know, we don't expect roads to pay for themselves. We don't expect the army to pay for themselves. Yeah. We don't expect the police. You know, the railway is a service, but it has a commercial side. And that's always the confusion because intercity, for example, can be profitable.
And make money.
And even commuter lines can make money if they're kind of run properly. But you can't make money out of the whole railway network if you're also trying to provide a service. But so there was always this search for the railway that was profitable. So, but towards the end of its life, British Rail was finally run by a very good railway man called Bob Reid. There were two Bob Reids. He was the first one of that name. And he created this structure, which some older listeners will remember, which was essentially the passenger services were divided into three, intercity, Network South East for the commuters around London, and the rest, the rump, which was regional railways. And the first two of those not only kind of improved service and the like, but they actually became profitable. Intercity was highly profitable. Network South East actually broke even or even made a kind of profit. But the important thing was they were given a lot of freedom, both from British Rail itself and by government. So they could make investment decisions. They had a budget that was set, and that's always problematic, of course, but they had a budget that was set. And they could also say, well, if we generate, you know, 5 or 10 million extra from this business, we can then spend it and reinvest it. So it was like proper businesses run by a very good cohort of managers who were trained within British Rail, who joined as graduate trainees and worked their way up to run these companies. And that was highly successful. And it only really fully came into being at the beginning of the 1990s. And lo and behold, just at the time where British Rail was an effective organisation, along comes the John Major government with some vague scheme to privatise it. They didn't know what they were doing. They said, oh, British Rail was not innovative, not kind of commercially minded, was, you know, had soggy sandwiches. Really stupid thing about
sandwiches. Come out
I mean, yes, it's a transport company, you know. Well, so what its sandwiches are like? You know, it's got nothing to do with it, you know. But, I mean, it's always this kind of stale sandwiches bit. And they destroyed what had been created only a few years before as an effective state-owned but not state-controlled organisation. It was a very good a kind of compromise between kind of state ownership and commercial mindedness. And that was destroyed. And so what Labour needs to do is to, as much as possible, recreate that. You can't kind of, you know, some of it is just broken up in such a way that it's very difficult. Like the rolling stock, for example, has been sold off and nobody's going to buy that again. But if you've got new rolling stock, you could actually buy it directly rather than leasing it and so on. So you could gradually work towards a coherent, integrated organization. And that's the key word, is integration. Because having a separate business which is a rail infrastructure company, is a nonsense. It's kind of what I've called in my writings very often, pretend capitalism. So you're pretending that you can make a profit out of something that, you know, has a very limited business, that has very little potential for growth, but, you know, you want it to kind of play at the capitalist game. And I argue very strongly that that's just nonsensical.
Yeah. Why it can't be seen as a public service, as you say, like the army and all these other things, we would be in a better position. Now, I heard you on a program the other day with a panel. There were too many on the panel, and so no argument developed. But it gave me the idea to get in touch with you to do this discussion. But someone else on the panel said, actually, although we all think it's better in other countries, it really isn't that much better. And that surprised me. Do you agree with that? That, you know, we kind of romanticize about France, Spain, Switzerland, Germany, maybe Japan? Or do you think, you travel on these things all the time, that we are in a much worse place than those countries?
Yes, I think that was Mark Smith of A Man at Seat 61.
Seat 61.
Who does know his stuff. But he didn't quite say that it's as bad over there. He just said it's not quite as we might dream about it. And yes, there's been problems in Germany, for example, where they've underinvested in their infrastructure and they're catching up and there's lots of train delays. There's industrial relations problems in France. But what he did say, and I do totally agree with that, that all those countries still have one big state-run organization. They might have privatized bits or they might have competition on some lines.
Someone's in control. An institution is in control.
Yeah, absolutely. And making decisions and getting investment. And for example, you know, in all those countries, there's been post-COVID recovery schemes. So, you know, in Germany, they had this €9 to use the railways for a month. In Spain, they've actually been running free service and so on. And they had enough imagination, enough scope to be able to do that and say, okay, we're going to foot the bill for this sort of scheme. In this country, we've had the £2 bus fare, which you know, outside London, which is an excellent idea, but there's been nothing similar on the railways. We still have, you know, fares between London and Manchester of £350 if you book it the day before. Like, insane stuff. So what that gives those countries is the ability for governments and the large state-run organizations to interact and to make big decisions. And it is also the case that undoubtedly average fares in those countries are lower. What we have in this country is advanced fares that you can get cheaply on long distance travel and so on. But there is not the kind of notion that you can connect with governments making political decisions, that we want to encourage people to use the railways as for environmental reasons, for health reasons, for all sorts of reasons. You might want to encourage people to use the railways rather than cars. And we don't have that potential of influencing a large state-run organization to promote rail use. And that's a great... And they're looking for that. They're looking at kind of, oh, we ought to reform the fares, and they certainly ought to reform the fares. We ought to have some, there's some, you know, overall organization guiding mind. But we're just paralyzed between the ideology of we must involve the private sector and the fact that in reality, the best way to run a railway is to have a state-run, a strong state-run railway at arm's length from day-to-day government decisions.
It's such a shame, isn't it? I mean, the railways, in a way, are a symbol, or should be a symbol, of great optimism and hope. You know, you turn up at a railway station, you see all those destinations. If it works, you can sit and read or work on the train. You get it should be fantastic. And I think in our lifetimes, it rarely has been. And at the moment, it is dire. I mean, just stepping back beyond all the kind of policy implications that we've explored, A, you must be so frustrated, because I know you use them all the time, trains, and you put your bike on them, and that's difficult on some lines. And why do we struggle with something which is potentially fantastic to well-being, to the economy, and yet we're in total insane chaos?
Yes, I think there's a great statement about the fact that in a civilized society, the public transport is not just for the poor. It's the rich use the trains rather than choosing cars. And I think that, you know, we have no such notion of kind of encouraging rail use across the board, making it, you know, we have a mean-spirited view of it. I mean, in Germany, for example, they have family carriages. They encourage people to, as you say, put their bikes on. They have dining cars still, at least decent kind of service. Whereas here, we cram in as many seats as possible. You know, you only have to go on those new Avanti trains which are in use on both the East Coast Mainline and the Great Western. And see, they cram in as many seats apart. They've taken out tables because tables take up space. They create seats that have no window view, despite the fact that by the window they kind of you can't see outside and so on. There's no effort, and this is odd because this is supposed to be private companies, but they're only interested in the kind of narrow basis of making money. So there's no notion of let's make railways really competitive with other kind of aspects, make it pleasant, you know, have nice spaces, you know. We've made some wonderful stations and stuff, but there's no kind of integrated idea of making the whole experience pleasant. You know, we have people, you know, gate lines, which are a real hassle to people, rather than having people checking your tickets because, like, you know, it's cheaper to do that and so on. And I think you're right. I mean, in all my writings about the railways, I always kind of try and promote the idea that they are, in a way, the apogee of civilization. The railways created modern capitalism. We could do another podcast on that subject, but they did. You know, they started 1830 and they kind of spread around the world, and they were the means of traveling kind of any kind of distance for, you know, almost 70, 80 years before we start getting cars. And I still think that's true today. The best way to travel for sort of reasonable distances is by rail. And we sort of seem to have forgotten that. We kind of have kind of promoted as this kind of rather nasty, mean kind of way of traveling that, you know, we'll just put up with the passengers if we have to. But, you know, really, it would be better if nobody used them at all.
Be much better if no one used them. Do you dare to hope that it could get good again, get good?
You know, I'm an old lefty, so, you know, if you're an old lefty, you have to kind of live in hope. And I do see ways forward. And that's, you know, look, trains, by and large, are kind of, you know, more efficient there's fewer accidents. You know, remember, it used to be kind of a lot of train accidents. And really, since 2000, there's been very few, only a couple of fatal crashes in the last 20 years. And that's a great improvement. There have been some wonderful station. You just look at that. I mean, I wrote a book about London stations, and you just look at those stations, and some of them are fantastic. You know, St. Pancras, London Bridge has been greatly improved, and so on, you know. And so I do look forward with optimism, but I just wish that politicians of all hues understood the greater value of public transport and railways in particular. And it's not just kind of a means of getting from A to B. It should be as a kind of real wonderful way to view the country, to get around fast, efficiently. I mean, it's just a more pleasant experience than driving, you know, from London to Manchester in 4 hours on the motorway. What is better than taking the train for 2 hours, 20 minutes? It should be a fantastic experience.
And your new podcast will be looking at the twists and turns on a kind of weekly basis, because at the moment, for sure, there are twists and turns all the time, which you have to analyse if you want to have any sense of what's going on in public transport in all forms.
Yes, we've called it Calling All Stations precisely because it looks at all aspects of transport. And, you know, transport is a great neglected area. I mean, I've made my living for the last 30 years writing about transport and kind of developing a niche there. And what's interesting is we all use transport every day. You know, there's very few people just stay at home all day. They're all either walking or cycling or driving or using public transport and whatever. And we don't talk about it much. And the transport secretary is the last person to kind of be appointed, you know, kind of. And we get really kind of inadequate people such as Chris Grayling, who was transport secretary for so long, just because he was the kind of last man standing when they were looking for ministers. And, you know, that's such a mistake. I mean, transport should be at the core of many policies, whether it's housing, whether it's employment, whether it's, you know, even security. You know, there's all sorts of aspects of our ways of life that transport plays a part and is totally neglected. So, you know, if there's one thing I've tried to do in all my writing is to promote the idea that transport is important, that it's been neglected, and it can be a great bonus.
Transport and housing are the two policy areas which affect all of us every day. And there are probably 30,000 podcasts on high politics, including this one. And you've started one up now on transport, and there won't be as many competitors.
And housing.
Transport and housing.
I used to work for Shelter many years ago, and that was the other one that people don't talk about.
Yeah. You know, the two big policy areas that touch us every day of our lives aren't big news priorities. It's very weird, isn't
it? I think it's because they're both terribly difficult. I do have some obvious solutions for transport, and there's some obvious solutions for housing, but they're actually very difficult to bring about. We know how to solve housing is to build more social housing, and to give people in the private rented sector.
How you get there
and so on. Transport is the same. We know what improves transport, but then it becomes war on the motorist, you know. And, you know, if you boost public transport and create bus lanes and encourage cycling, you know, we get into culture wars. Amazing culture wars over low transport neighbourhoods, you know. It's extraordinary. It's a shame. It should be. That's something that, you know, you talked about Europe and stuff. That's something they do better in Europe on the whole. That there isn't these great, terrible political divides over transport. I mean, France has 25 towns with trams. You know, we have half a dozen and we struggle to build any more, and they're building them all the time. China has 48 places with metro systems.
Really?
48. Yes. Wow. I checked that out the other day. And so, you know, and we invented the underground, right? 1863, London's the world's first underground. We invented it, you know, and we have a dozen lines in London. We have Glasgow and sort of Newcastle and sort of Liverpool, and that's it. Yeah. So, you know, we could really do with putting it further up the agenda.
No question. Well, look, good luck with Call Your Stations. And Christian, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So that was Christian Wolmar. As I say, he's got his own podcast, Calling All Stations, a new podcast exploring all kind of elements of transport. And I think, you know, we've got to carry on probing as to why we're in this state. And an interview coming up will be with Andy Burnham, who, of course, is mayor of Greater Manchester. And one of his big themes has been transport. And be fascinating to hear what he's done to the buses. Because, again, buses, like trains, bring in not just the importance of delivery and a way in which people, the so-called left behind, can be reconnected. If you get proper buses with affordable fares, people without cars suddenly become connected again. Deregulation in the 80s, an overlooked problem. Can it drive growth? Can it deal with regional inequalities? Huge themes. Anyway, we'll be talking to Andy Burnham about some of these very soon, hopefully, and lots of other interesting interviewees being lined up. But more immediately, well, there's a lot going on, isn't there? The fallout from Zahawi, the issues relating to Dominic Raab and the strikes, so many kind of themes whirling around. So within days, we need to get back together again to make sense of it all. In the meantime, enjoy yourselves, whatever you're doing, as far as you can. And thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Take care. Bye.